This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Happy Friday. I'm Ted Chen from KNBC, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Our first story, Congress has reached a deal which amounts to a major overhaul of the landmark surveillance law known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, better known as FISA, which Congress passed in 1978 after the Watergate scandals. The deal amounts to legal immunity for the telecommunications companies for their participation in the wiretapping program after the September 11th attacks. Democratic and Republican leaders struck the deal yesterday, which in some respects strengthens the government's ability to eavesdrop without court orders, but a deal which Democrats say also contains new restrictions. Joining us to talk about this, Greg Miller, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Greg, thanks for coming on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a victory, really a complete victory for the Bush administration, and how so?
It's hard to find any way that this isn't really a complete victory for the Bush administration. I guess, you know, Democrats in the House pointed to a number of accomplishments, things that they say they won in negotiations with the Senate over the past 3 or 4 months. But by and large, this is a codification of a warrantless wiretapping program that the Bush administration started in secret after the 9/11 attacks.
Talk about the telecommunications companies first and how this affects them.
Well, this is they lobbied heavily for a provision in this bill that will shield them from lawsuits for participating in this espionage program. After the 9/11 attacks, President Bush authorizes this program, which involves the government going to AT&T, Verizon, and other telecommunications companies and saying, we need to plug into your networks so that we can pull out emails and phone calls that we feel we need to listen in on. And these companies did so for a number of years before this became public. And there are many questions about whether that was legal or illegal. So there are a number of lawsuits targeting these companies. But this bill that was hammered out this week would make all those lawsuits go away.
Is that pretty much certain? Because I know that was asserted by a Republican senator that the lawsuits are simply going to disappear, and we're pretty certain of that?
Yeah, because there's a step here that these companies have to take to make it happen, but it's not a very onerous step. They have to show these district courts that are handling these suits just a piece of paper that shows that they were approached by the government, that they had a request in writing from the government, and that as part of this request, they were told that this was A, legal, and B, authorized by President Bush. Well, these companies already have these documents, so just merely showing these to the court shouldn't be any problem.
Let's sort out when the government can wiretap and what restrictions are in place for that. Calls that Americans make overseas, I know, are separate from strictly foreign calls.
That's right. I mean, what this does is this is mostly aimed at international calls, and not only calls coming into or out of the United States, but foreign-to-foreign calls that might pass through U.S. telecommunications network. A lot of the world's communications traffic now travels through networks in the United States. So this enables the government to surveil calls or emails on targets overseas that come through the United States without a warrant.
Without individual warrants.
It does not enable the government to, you can't, you know, the government will still need a warrant to tap a U.S. citizen's calls, whether in the United States or abroad, and in particular calls from one place in the United States to another place in the United States.
But there are some time restrictions on that as well, or in terms of 3 days versus 7 days. Can you elaborate that?
Well, there are emergency provisions that allow the government to go up on surveillance targets in emergency circumstances for up to, I think, 7 days, and I'm still reading through some of the fine print on this legislation, but then have to make a showing to the court or then follow up with further paperwork for the court to allow that to continue.
So they can listen up to 7 days without a warrant on foreign-to-foreign calls or on American calls to foreign countries?
On foreign-to-foreign calls, not only that, but also foreign targets that might be trading emails or phone calls with someone in the United States, as long as that overseas target is not a U.S. citizen. And in cases, you know, the idea here is that they will inadvertently collect information or the contents of communications of Americans, but those that information is supposed to be minimized under these procedures. So you can listen to somebody overseas talking to somebody in the United States, but you have to sort of discard all of the stuff that you get on the U.S. person, unless you want to make that person a target, and then you need a warrant.
And how does the FISA court play into all of this? Because previously, what Democrats seem to be arguing is that at least this new law that FISA has to be notified in advance instead of having 3 months to notify FISA.
Well, the role of the FISA court now is largely to look at the procedures by which the government operates its electronic espionage. And it's going to do a lot less of reviewing case-by-case requests to eavesdrop on a specific person, and will instead be issuing what they call basket or bucket warrants, which allow the government to, for up to a year, to target multiple individuals as long as the procedures that they use for identifying those targets have been approved.
And can you summarize why the administration feels it's important that it has this power?
Well, the case for this is that technology made the old laws obsolete, that the old law passed in 1978, came long before the internet, long before cell phones. So it was not designed for a world in which calls between a terrorist overseas and either someone in the United States or someone somewhere else might still go through these U.S. networks. And so that kept tripping the government up, because one of the FISA court judges ruled last year or 2 years ago that any time these calls come into the United States and pass through an AT&T switch or a Verizon switch, that the government needed a warrant. And the government thought, we can't track Al-Qaeda if we're going to have to file warrants every time one of their emails comes through a U.S. network.
Greg Miller of the Los Angeles Times, a staff writer, thanks so much for joining us. Now joining us, Mark Rotenberg. He is the executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Mark, thanks for joining us on Air Talk.
Sure.
Let me ask you about that last argument by the Bush administration that the sophistication and speed of today's telecommunications requires that the government have this broad flexibility to wiretap, sometimes without warrant.
Right. Well, we actually reached the opposite conclusion in our discussions with the administration and others on this issue. In other words, given the sophistication of signals intelligence today and the extent of data mining and the ability to profile users of new communication networks in ways that could not have been anticipated in 1978, our view is actually that the privacy provisions of the FISA needed to be strengthened, that there should be more oversight, more accountability, and greater judicial review. And I think that's actually consistent with the general approach in the development of privacy law in the U.S. The administration, of course, took a different position. They said, given the advances in technology, they felt they needed to have greater authority to conduct intercept, less oversight, less judicial review. And I think that in part explains why we've reached the point that we have with this legislation.
Mark, Democrats are saying that the law, the wiretapping law, has been strengthened in that the government needs to obtain individual court orders to wiretap Americans who are outside the U.S., and that the FISA court needs to give advance approval to procedures for wiretapping operations. Are those pluses in your mind?
Well, I actually don't think those were the major accomplishments. I mean, those provisions, or at least those principles, were in place in the FISA well before the current debate began. I think one of the accomplishments here was to make clear that the statutory basis for intercept was the exclusive basis for the conduct of this activity in the United States. And that's actually a very important point, because one of the big issues that surrounds the debate over FISA is whether the president has independent authority under Article 2 of the Constitution to conduct domestic warrantless wiretap without a statutory basis and without judicial review. It was a position that the president had taken. He had backed off that position, and Congress had spent some time trying to get that locked in the new legislation. And I think the White House has now agreed to that. If there is going to be wiretapping, it's going to be done either under the FISA or the 1968 Federal Wiretap Act. I think the other significant achievements have to do with some new means of oversight. The Inspector General, for example, has given some new authorities to conduct a review of the program. The FISA court has some new review authorities. But as to the key principles in FISA, it's clear that there has been some serious chipping away at key Fourth Amendment principles. One of the key Fourth Amendment principles, for example, is individualized suspicion. And the way the FISA court had always operated in the past is that for the government to get a warrant, the application authority to conduct the intercept, there had to be an actual target. And that was the basis for the FISA court to make its determination. As your earlier guest pointed out, under the new statutory provision, so the government can basically get the authority to intercept without knowing precisely who they are intercepting or what they're looking for. And that's a very significant and, I would say, somewhat alarming change in the structure of federal wiretap law.
And how does that square with the government's argument that this mining process is so broad and so sweeping that there really isn't any specific effort to listen in on people's phone calls or look at their email?
Well, that actually goes back to my original point, which I think, you know, properly understood in terms of the impact of technology on the government's ability to conduct surveillance. I think the conclusion that most people would reach is that you need greater oversight authority to ensure that, you know, this doesn't become sort of an open-ended fishing expedition. And that's always the concern when you think about the authority that the government has granted to conduct surveillance. I don't think anyone, you know, frankly, would disagree that where there's, you know, legitimate probable cause, whatever your standard is going to be, reason to believe that, you know, someone is planning a terrorist attack or criminal act requiring the intervention of government agents, that the wiretap or intercept or data collection should go forward. No one has ever disputed that particular proposition. The concern, of course, is that this tends, in fact, to be a much more open-ended authority. Intelligence gathering, for example, really can touch on a wide range of subjects, a wide range of people, not only non-U.S. citizens, but also U.S. citizens. And so the question in the drafting of the statute is how to narrow that authority. And I think many people in the civil liberties community believe that the House and their bill has not done an adequate job narrowing that authority to make sure that it is not used in an open-ended manner, essentially allowing the government to conduct surveillance on whomever they wish.
Thank you so much, Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, on a deal struck by Congress overhauling wiretapping by the Bush administration, or rather the law that would guide that wiretapping. And coming up, we'll talk about Scott McClellan, the former White House spokesperson, and his testimony before Congress today. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Pasadena Water and Power. Landscape professionals advise that most people overwater their lawns by 50%. Overwatering weakens the root system and wastes water. If everyone in Southern California cuts outdoor watering one day per week, we could save 73 billion gallons of water per year. You can save water by irrigating only two times per week. For more information, you can go to PasadenaSavesWater.com.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Next Book, presenting Jewish Geography on Sunday, June 29th, a festival of ideas exploring place, design, memory, and imagination, featuring architects, writers, activists, and artists, including Julia Shulman, Shalom Auslander, Daphne Merkin, Andy Lipkis, Mia Lehrer, and Peter Eisenman. The day begins with a free family festival, and all events take place at UCLA's McGowan Hall. For tickets, call 310-825-2101 or click on nextbook.org. As if they need more rain in Missouri and Iowa, with a number of towns either bracing for flooding or dealing with it already, but more rain could be coming anyway, making flooding even more inevitable in towns along the Mississippi, just upstream from St. Louis. Here in the Southland, we're in for another scorcher, with temps expected to soar past the 100 mark again in the valleys, and more records are expected to be set. Forecasters say some parts of the San Fernando Valley could hit 113. Because of the high heat, low humidity, and the wind, the National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning, which will be in effect until 8 tomorrow night. It's 1021.
Looking for some ideas on things to do, where to go, and what to see? Sign up for KPCC's monthly Arts and Culture newsletter. Delivered to your inbox every month, it contains information on the Southland's cultural happenings. Visit kpcc.org and click on the newsletter's link to sign up.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Manta. Hope you're having a terrific Friday morning. Former White House spokesman Scott McClellan is testifying before the House Judiciary Committee today. He has stated that President Bush and Vice President Cheney wanted him to say that Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Libby, was not involved in the leak of Valerie Plame's identity. The former CIA operative whose identity was leaked to the media. In this clip, we have Texas Republican Lamar Smith asking McClellan about that leak.
And is it true that Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage has admitted that he was the source of the Valerie Plame leak?
Well, to Robert Novak, but there were other reporters that information was revealed to prior to it being public. There was a report in the Washington Post that he identified at least six reporters were told about her identity.
And wasn't that the first public leak?
That was the first time it was published, right. But it was revealed. Her identity was revealed to
multiple
reporters.
That was the first time. That's correct. That's correct. That was the first time her name was published.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you over the buzzer. Okay. The first time her name was published. Yes, right. But I mean, I'd like to make the point.
Richard Armitage.
Could I finish my answer?
Armitage has admitted that he was the source. Do you agree with that? Or do you question his
admission? He was the initial source for Robert Novak. Karl Rove was the confirming
and that was
source.
The first, and that was,
Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, Ari Fleischer.
And that was
also,
the first time.
Can I finish my response?
And that was the first time her name.
They also revealed her identity to other reporters prior to it being published publicly.
But that was the first time her name was ever published. Was when it appeared.
Yes, as I point out in the book, that's correct.
That is Texas Republican Lamar Smith questioning McClellan about the leak of Valerie Plame's identity to the media. Joining us is Brad Sherman, Democratic congressman from the San Fernando Valley's 27th District. Congressman Sherman, thanks for joining us on Air Talk.
Good to be with you, Ted.
First, your thoughts on that exchange between Congressman Smith and the former White House spokesperson.
Well, I know that throughout these hearings, Scott is mentioning his book, and I think his book will do well after these hearings.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he's mentioning his book a lot. His book is sitting with him on the table as he speaks, and I'm glad that he is voluntarily coming before our committee and giving us a spotlight into the Bush administration.
But are you suggesting he's only doing so to sell books?
Well, no, he's doing so because we asked him to come.
Well, what do you think of his testimony so far?
I haven't learned anything new, but it has been it's been interesting, and I don't think it's a surprise to anyone to learn to see the Valerie Plame facts again and to learn that this was an administration dedicated to selling its policies to the American people, and they at least exaggerated what they wanted to say and failed to provide the other information. This is a misleading administration, and Scott was part of that.
Can you elaborate what you mean by interesting? You say you didn't learn anything new, but do you consider the book and what it reveals credible?
So nothing has come out at the hearings that I think is new that wasn't also in the book. But this is an opportunity for us to probe, to ask some questions, and I think he's being as responsive as he can be.
As far as questions are concerned, what particular questions did you want to see answered, and were they answered?
Well, I did an email to those of my constituents who had signed up for my email alerts asking them what questions I should ask, and some of them, fortunately or unfortunately, have already been asked by my colleagues, so I won't take the time to ask them again. One of those is, did Cheney tell Libby to leak the Valerie Plame information, and of course, McClellan just didn't know.
And he stated that he was told by then Chief of Staff Andrew Card that Card was instructed by the President and the Vice President to say that Scooter Libby was not the leak. Mm. Did you find that testimony credible?
Yes. The press secretary went out and said what he was told to say, and it turned out that what he was told to say was false. And I'm trying to see whether this relates, whether this crosses the line from political skullduggery to something criminal. If it was a crime for a press secretary to lie to the press, we'd have our jails would be filled with presidents and former presidents and almost everybody who has been involved. It is not a shock to find out that the press secretary was told to go out and say things that weren't true, especially not a shock from the Bush administration, which is, if anything, known for that. I'm trying to see whether this was an effort not just to mislead the public, which the Bush administration has done so often, but to mislead prosecutors or to impair the administration of justice. So far, I haven't seen that connection. Then again, I'm not an expert in the prosecution of Libby or the investigation of Karl Rove.
In fact, I believe McClellan himself has said he does not believe there was necessarily any criminal wrongdoing on the part of anyone in the White House. And if indeed there is nothing in his testimony that might point in that direction, what kind of use do you see any in his testimony before Congress today? You seemed rather skeptical at the beginning of this conversation about any usefulness.
Well, it's going to be useful to the American public to get a C-SPAN view and later newspaper report view, and of course we're on radio now, of the spin machine inside the White House that was so misleading with regard to Iraq and so misleading with regard to so many other things. So just because something is in Scott's book doesn't mean that presenting it in this new way won't help to educate the American people. And we may learn some additional details. I've got some questions I'll be asking in about 15, 20 minutes. And I hope...
Can you preview those?
Well, one of them will be putting aside what's in your book. Are there other occasions where the information you gave the press you later learned was false or misleading? Now, I would assume that he put all of those instances in his book, but it'd be nice to find out if there are some others. And, of course, he's testifying under oath, which is not typical but not unknown here on the Hill, and so this the onus will be on him to try to think of some other circumstances.
Do you suspect that there are others, and in particular, are you concerned about any particular issues?
I can't answer that. You know, I don't know how the question will be answered. That question is clearly a fishing expedition, but I can't tell you that there's a particular fish out there that I'm trying to catch.
Does it pertain to Iraq? Would any of your questions pertain to that?
Well, the question pertains to Iraq and everything else that this administration has been doing. And it'll be interesting to see whether, in addition to what he's told us in the book, there are some other instances. Because that's, I think, what is most revealing here, is are there circumstances where he was out there giving false information, where he can now come before this committee and say, I said it to the press, I later learned out that it was false.
All right. Thank you so much, Brad Sherman, Democratic congressman from the San Fernando Valley's 27th district, who will be part of the questioning of former White House spokesman Scott McClellan, who is before Congress today. And coming up on Air Talk, we're going to open up our phones and ask for your thoughts on the Democratic, the presumptive Democratic nominee Barack Obama and his decision to reject public financing. It is apparent that he broke a pledge to do so earlier this year. Did he do the right thing, or did he make a mistake? We want to hear from you. Our phone line, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Back in just a second. And welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Citing the potential of attacks from independent groups on the right, Senator Barack Obama announced yesterday that he would opt out of the public financing system for the general election. He became the first major party candidate to reject public financing and its attendant spending limits. All the major candidates have accepted public financing in presidential elections since 1976, but Senator Obama says that the public financing system is broken and that his Republican opponents are masters, what he calls gaming the system, and would spend millions of dollars in unlimited donations through 527s, much like what happened in 2004 and those infamous Swift boat ads on then-candidate John Kerry. Senator Obama has already spent up to $4 million in 18 states unveiling a new ad, a new television ad. Joining us to talk about this, Peter Nicholas, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Your assessment on Obama doing this, I mean, it seems pretty clear. He did make a pledge that he would go into the public financing system in a questionnaire last fall. Is this going to in any way backfire on him?
Well, potentially could. Some good government groups are very concerned and disappointed about Obama's decision. They feel that this is a setback for the cause of public financing in these campaigns. To have a prominent person like Barack Obama, who is an advocate of political reform and has talked about the importance of public financing in campaigns, to opt out of the system and back away from it, they think is definitely a setback, and that may make it harder to enact such a program and to improve and expand such a program. So, to the extent that Obama is promising to be a different kind of politician, somebody who's not going to play the traditional Washington game, it may leave some of his supporters his position may leave some of his supporters confused.
What about the argument that because Barack Obama raises so much money on the internet and so much money from small donors, he in effect is already being publicly financed, and by doing it the way he's doing it, he is and is already relying less on the major donors and the big pocketed donors that the public financing system was designed to curb the influence of?
Well, there is some truth to that. Barack Obama has about 1.4 million donors, and he's received many donors. He's received contributions of under $200 from many donors. So he argues that he's set up essentially a parallel public financing system. But it's also true that he has larger donors as well. He has donors who've given the maximum $2,300 contributions in a primary. And he has bundlers. He has well-heeled businessmen who are helping him and to raise money. He's actively recruiting Hillary Clinton's campaign finance network. So there's another side to that story, too.
Our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We'd like to hear from you and get your thoughts, whether you are an Obama supporter or whether you are not. Was it smart for him to break from the public finance system, the $84 million that the government offers presidential candidates, that each presidential candidate has taken since 1976, at least the major ones. 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Peter Nicholas of the LA Times, this also means essentially that Barack Obama is going to have to do a lot of more work fundraising now, although that has come he's done well by it.
He certainly has. He's raised about $265 million since his campaign began in January of 2007, and there's every indication that he's going to be able to raise substantially more money. He's done well with that. Many of his donors, as I mentioned, have donated far less than the $2,300 maximum, so Obama can go back to tens of thousands of donors and ask for more contributions. He's in good position. As I mentioned, too, he's now inheriting Hillary Clinton's campaign finance network. Her supporters may start donating to Obama.
And some of those are pretty big donors.
Yeah, and some of the estimates are that he could raise $200 to $300 million before the general election in November. So he's in a good position.
So 200 to 300 that would be spent strictly from the end of August until November, which is a very short time frame. And talk about how this changes the electoral map, if you will, and changes the strategy if he potentially has that much money to spend on election, more than any other presidential candidate has ever had for such a short period of time.
Well, bear in mind that Obama is the first major party candidate since 1976 to do this. Other candidates have accepted the public money, and in doing so, they're accepting fundraising restraints. There's a limit to how much they can spend. Barack Obama, in making this decision, has no such limits. He can spend whatever he wants. He can spend as much as he takes in. So he can campaign everywhere. He can campaign in all 50 states. He can run ads in traditionally Republican states. He may not expect to win those states, but he can force John McCain onto the defensive. He can force McCain to plow resources and money and staff into states that he would like to take for granted and thus deplete McCain's resources. So Obama can expand the electoral map. He doesn't have to compete just in traditionally Democratic states. He can go everywhere by virtue of the small fortune, large fortune that he's raised.
And he's already targeted these so-called red states, Montana, North Carolina, and North Dakota, among some.
That's right. He's looking at Virginia. He wants to be competitive in North Carolina. He thinks he can do well in red states. This was part of his argument during the primary season. So the money puts him at quite a competitive advantage, and he's poised to wage the kind of campaign that we have not seen in American politics by virtue of this money.
Let's start taking some phone calls. Our phone number, once again, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Your thoughts on Barack Obama's rejection of $84 million in public financing, the first major party candidate to do so since such financing started in 1976. Let's go to Roberta in Cyprus. Roberta, good morning. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, it's actually Cyprus Park.
Yeah. There wasn't enough room on the computer screen for the park part, so
right.
Go ahead, Cyprus.
Big difference. Well, I'm a wholehearted Obama supporter, and I'm also.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what, Roberta? I have to interrupt you. I lost focus on the clock. We only have a few seconds. I will come back to you when we come back after the break. 89.3 KPCC is the station. You're listening to Air Talk, and we're taking open phones on Barack Obama's rejection of public financing.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Torrance Cultural Arts Center, presenting Christopher Cross Friday, June 27th. This special show will feature all his classic 1980s Grammy and Oscar-winning hits, plus a gourmet dinner, live and silent auctions, dancing under the stars, and a champagne reception. Proceeds benefit the arts in the South Bay. Tickets to this evening with Christopher Cross are available now at torrancearts.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC online at kpcc.org. Well, now that it's feeling like summer, Southland Utilities are reminding customers how to keep their cool without straining the electrical grid. KPCC's Cheryl Duvall counts the ways.
Some of the energy savers line up with what you're probably already doing. Who'd want to crank up the stove to cook in the heat of the day? And why not draw the shades, the better to deflect the sun's glare? Both of those strategies limit the need for air conditioning, and that makes it easier to set the thermostat at the recommended 78 degrees. Southern California Edison and LA's Department of Water and Power are making that recommendation. They're also suggesting the kinds of electricity-saving tips that apply year-round. Shutting off lights and appliances when you're not using them. Changing out incandescent light bulbs for compact fluorescents. Swapping older model washers, refrigerators, and the like for newer, more efficient ones. All that will help ensure enough power to meet the demand this hot season. Cheryl Duvall, 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Hollywood Bowl, presenting Bugs Bunny on Broadway on July 5th at 8 p.m. This evening of cartoon hilarity features classic Looney Tunes like What's Opera Doc, The Rabbit of Seville, and many more, projected on the Bowl's big screens, while the Los Angeles Philharmonic accompanies them live with the quintessential cartoon music. Tickets and information available at HollywoodBowl.com. The Hollywood Bowl, part of your life.
Thank you.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Election coverage on air and online at kpcc.org. And we're talking about the presidential election and Barack Obama's rejection yesterday of $84 million federal dollars in public financing. He is now the first major candidate to do so since 1976. And during every presidential election, the major candidates have accepted the public financing system. Barack Obama rejected it yesterday, in large part because he has done such a significant and impressive job of fundraising on his own. But that decision brought immediate criticism from his opponent, the presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain, who said Obama broke his pledge and his promise to accept public financing. But we'd like to get your thoughts on this. Our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. In particular, I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether you believe Barack Obama has somehow tarnished his reformist image, his pledge to change Washington, by doing so, by rejecting public financing. We want to go back to first, we want to thank Peter Nicholas of the LA Times for talking to us about this and discussing this. And we want to go back to Roberta in Cypress Park. And Roberta, sorry we interrupted you before. We ran out of time there, but go ahead with your thoughts.
Yeah, that's okay. I just want to say I completely, wholeheartedly support Obama, and I support campaign finance reform and also public financing, and I've worked for it on a grassroots level. But with the way things are now, with the 527s being able to spend whatever they want, you really don't have any control. I mean, actually, I think Obama refusing the public financing, he'll be able to control everything that's out there, and the message that he's going to get out there is what he wants out there. I mean, there are a lot of, Bush in the past could say, I don't have anything to do with the Swift voters, but, he probably really approved it. So I think it'll be a lot better, actually, for Obama. His message will get out. I think it'll, on his side, there'll be a lot less of the horrible tactics that went on in the last couple of elections. So
Roberta, if one of your Republican friends said to you, I don't trust Barack Obama anymore because he broke his promise on public financing, you would say what?
Well, first of all, I don't think it was a promise. Second of all, people change their minds. At the time when he thought that he would do it, he didn't realize that he would be able to raise so much money from the average American. I mean, I have $100 a month going to him, and I think there are a lot of people out there like me. I mean, I support him, but I don't have $2,300 to give him at one shot.
$100 a month, so you still have room to go before November and still not
exactly
reach the limit then. Okay.
Exactly, and I think there are probably a lot of people out there. So anyway, with 527s, I just don't see this as really an issue.
Okay, thank you so much, Roberta, in Cypress Park. 866-893-5722 is our number, 866-893-KPCC. Let's go to Judy in Brentwood. Judy, good morning. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. Actually, Roberta said exactly what I was just about to say, which is that Republicans have already far more of these 527 groups ready to go, and McCain hasn't shown any willingness to stop them. He basically has said he has no control over what they say.
He said he doesn't like what they do, and wants them to stop. He said he wants them to stop, but
he's not really putting. I mean, I think that if he really wanted to put the pressure on these groups to not do these kind of smear campaigns, he definitely could. I mean, the Republican Party would listen, and they wouldn't do this. And they are showing McCain is showing no intent on trying to really truly stop it. They also apparently McCain and Obama were supposed to meet and work out some kind of understanding about how the public financing campaign would go in the fall. And they apparently McCain didn't really want to meet and didn't really get together with Obama over that. So I think Obama made the right decision. I think basically the Democrats have MoveOn.org as their 527, and that's it. The Republicans have many, many more resources on that level.
Okay.
So I agree with Roberta, and I don't fault Obama for going back on his decision to take public financing.
Thank you so much, Judy from Brentwood. We would like to hear from any of you who may believe that, or may be a little disappointed, who are supporters of Obama, may be a little disappointed about the senator's decision, perhaps because you are a big supporter and a big believer in public financing, which many critics and public watchdogs are now concerned will now disappear, that Senator Obama's decision means the end of public financing, which appears to be a real possibility now. Let's go to Sing K in Hollywood. Welcome to Air Talk. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Go ahead.
So I was a Hillary supporter, one of the only black people I know who supported Hillary. And I think it's smart that he did. I think it's going to help him win. But what's annoying is, this is from Roberta and the other person, this is classic Obama supporters. It's, no matter what Obama does, it's okay. Like, it's clearly he broke his word. Clearly he said he was going to do that. He made, apparently from reports, no aggressive efforts to do it, but he knows it's going to help him win. And so he's going to, I think it's smart. But I tell you, if Hillary had done it, it would have been another thing. Like, when she was pushing to get Florida and Michigan seated, they were like, how dare she? She's going back on her word and da-da-da. And now Barack's doing the same thing. And again, I don't really care. I think if it helps him get there, if it helps Democrats win, more power to him. But let's just be clear about, like, what's going on. This means he does what he needs to do to win. Hillary very often did what she needed to do to win. But let's stop pretending that this guy is a saint. It's very annoying. It's what we dealt with in the primary the whole time. You know, Hillary did something, she got slammed. He did the same thing. Oh, it's no big deal. Let's support him. You know, he's an honest and an innocent guy, honest and innocent guy. And it's just very aggravating. But
you believe
he's got my vote over McCain, but it's just more of the same. And if I were in McCain's camp, you know, given, anyway, I'll just.
No, I see your point, Sinke. You believe his political calculations are pretty much as the same as Hillary Clinton or John McCain's. And somehow he's gotten a pass from both the media and the public.
They would be screaming bloody murder. She can't be trusted. She signed a pledge that says she's going to do this, and now she didn't do it. See, she's a conniving witch. You know, give me a break.
All right. Thank you so much, Sing K in Hollywood. Our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Let's go to Michelle in Silver Lake. Michelle, good morning.
Morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well. I just believe it's a different political landscape these days. It takes a lot more money to win elections. And the fact of the matter is, regardless of whether or not Obama went back in his word, it takes a lot of money to win political elections. And McCain probably would have done the same thing had he not been the architect of the 2002 McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act. He is essentially politically tied at the wrist, and he cannot move outside of that realm and those restrictions. So it precludes him from going the way that Obama has. But at the same time, like Roberta was saying earlier, you have the 527s that are spending billions and billions of dollars to get Republicans elected, and that was obviously clear in during the Kerry election. And, you know, I don't think that Obama's campaign staff wants him to be defeated in that type of fashion, so they're taking whatever precautions they can to make sure that they are covering all ends, from 527 to, you know, the $84 million that's provided under the Campaign Reform Act.
So. Michelle, what about Sing K's assertion that Obama's supporters will essentially forgive anything he does?
Well, I that is certainly true, and I could say that I am guilty of that at the same fashion, but I think that Democrats in general, you know, we've had 8 years of a president that's just, you know, been dishonest and lied to us and, you know, completely upturned the financial stability of this country. And I think that at this moment, regardless of you know, who is going back on a word or what, it's time for us to take back the White House, and we have taken back Congress. And, you know, it might be time to just forgive and forget and move on and do what we need to do to win.
Okay. Thank you so much, Michelle in Silver Lake. Our phone number once again, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. We're having open calls on Barack Obama's rejection of public financing, whether it was the right thing to do, whether it was the smart thing to do, or whether We'd like to hear from you if you're disappointed by it as an Obama supporter or as a McCain supporter. Let's go to John in Reseda. John, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, good morning. I'm extremely disappointed by this. I think this guy obviously wants to do anything to win. I'm a liberal Democrat, and I'm originally a Hillary Clinton supporter and fundraiser, and I'm already getting emails telling me to, you know, start sending money to the National Committee and to Barack Obama's campaign. And I think this will probably be the first year that either I'll be writing Clinton's name in or I just won't be voting for a Democrat. I know Obama will be carrying California, but definitely not with my vote or my money. This is especially coming on disappointing news that the Democrats are compromising and pushing George Bush out in a blaze of glory by giving him everything he wants with the wiretapping legislation.
So, John, as a Clinton supporter, were you open to supporting Obama? And did this kind of, was this the straw that broke the camel's back? Or were you never going to support Obama?
This was a tough year for me because these were two awfully excellent candidates. And not that I think that she should be chosen as a vice president. I don't think that's going to fool anybody. But I was definitely open towards supporting him. I'm still smarting from her dropping out. But, you know, it's still incredibly early before the general election. But this along with what's going on in the House, I'm just starting to not see any difference between Democrats and Republicans. I know the Supreme Court is in play. But I think if it was closer in California, which is a very deep blue state, maybe I would be thinking differently, but this is more of like a protest thing for me. So I'm just not going to be, you know, giving any kind of financial support to the top of the ticket.
Thanks so much, John. But it's an interesting point that not only independents and McCain supporters, but Hillary Clinton supporters are going to be watching Barack Obama's behavior and actions and decisions very closely in making their decision whether to throw their full support behind him. And if you are one such voter, we'd love to hear from you as well. Like John, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Let's go to George in Redondo Beach. George, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a registered Republican, and I voted for John McCain in the California primaries. And actually, I was very impressed with what Obama did. Here's someone who may end up being president of the United States and involved in negotiating with other world leaders. And what he did is he saw what was going to be best for his campaign and took the heat. He had to know that he would be slammed for being unprincipled and undisciplined and betraying, but he saw what was going to be best, and I just feel that was pretty impressive.
George, you say you were a McCain supporter, and McCain believes in public financing, and obviously with the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, believes in campaign finance reform, at least to some extent. Can you reconcile that? Do you still believe in public financing?
No, I don't believe in public financing.
Okay.
And, I think it came out of the Watergate era. I think it was an overreaction, and it has had way too many loopholes.
Okay.
I would love to see true public financing. Both candidates receive the same amount of money. I know that there's a free speech issues with the 527s, but there's always ways to go ahead and find the money that you want.
Thanks so much, George. Let's go to Brandon, who is on the either the 5 or the 10 freeway right now. Brandon, go ahead. Good morning.
Approaching the 10 freeway.
There you go.
I think that your discussion is sort of missing the point. Candidates and the competition that's gone on in the Democratic Party over these last months has been fierce. And both candidates want to win, and both of them are looking at the situation as it plays out and trying to be able to get some kind of advantage, and certainly this will give Obama advantage. Certainly you're not going to be able to bring about any kind of changes in terms of any kind of legislation if you don't win. So ultimately, this is just a principled approach, looking at a broken system and trying to be able to determine what you need to do to be able to get your message out. And I actually happen to agree with the previous caller. It shows a sense of what's necessary to be able to rally the troops. Certainly, if you can get a lot of money, you'll be able to get your message out. And the Republicans have been able to do that and frame the message fairly well for the past 8 years.
Brandon, I assume the concern, though, among critics and among public watchdogs, among believers in public financing, is that if Barack Obama is running as a reformist and he's willing to shift on that, some of the changes that you like to see made, he might back off on those as well.
Well, all politicians have to make deals. I mean, we're in a very complex society where there are numbers of interest groups. So ultimately, you're able to move your agenda forward as far as you can based on sort of what's happening on the ground. And certainly, there is a huge distinction between what John McCain and Barack Obama are running on. So I suspect, for example, that he will try and put together, if should he be the winner, the kinds of reforms that he's able to put together, given the context that in which he's existing in. I mean, no one would have thought about how this country would have moved before the attacks of 9/11. So ultimately, what happens on the ground really determines how a candidate's able to move forward.
Okay, I think we have time for one or two more. Brandon, thank you very much. Let's go to Mary in Hollywood. Mary, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Hi. A lot of people have said pretty much what I thought, but I'm kind of curious why we're not focusing on the positive element, such as the fact that this is kind of bringing democracy, active democracy, back into the campaign, where, you know, small donors are so important, and bake sales and things that Obama supporters are doing. I think it's really inspiring.
Thank you, Mary. We did bring that up at the beginning of the program, that the Obama campaign is arguing, because he gets so many donations from small donors and through the internet, that this is in effect public financing, because the support is so widespread and among smaller donors in the Obama campaign. Let's go to Tom in Glendale. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. A lot of people have said a lot of this, but the BCRA, which is the McCain-Feingold law, is broken. So what we need to do is take this and work it to the best advantage. Look at clean money, which is in operation in Arizona. Interestingly, a Democratic woman governor in John McCain's Republican home state, Vermont. Lonnie Hancock's bill in California. Let's take this to the next step forward and utilize the wonderment that Howard Dean started with the internet and that Obama has capped on.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. We ran out of time. Coming up next, we'll talk